Welcome to Snack Break. We speak to experts, mostly about policy, but also about snacks.
The world is a mess. American relations with North Korea are the worst they've been in 65 years. Venezuela is falling apart, and it was reported this summer that 20 American diplomats in Cuba were the target of sonic attacks that caused some brain damage and loss of hearing. On the plus side, Amazon has slashed prices of kale and avocados at Whole Foods, and Google Photos now has the ability to recognize your pets. I'm Arut Mukherjee, and here with me today to make sense of this crazy world is Harvard professor and the man who coined the term soft power, Joe Nye. Joe, thank you so much for joining.
Glad to be with you.
Just for a second, can we just talk about what is happening right now? You've been witnessing and observing American foreign policy for decades. What's going on?
Well, everybody says that we've never seen things so bad, but in fact we have. If you lived through the 1960s, you saw three major assassinations. You saw two presidents driven from office, Johnson and Nixon. And you saw here at Harvard students basically attacking people physically. My building, the Center for International Affairs, was bombed. I would argue that things are bad today, but I've seen worse.
You don't think that the number of crises that are ongoing or are in any way are more, it's just that...
Well, there are different types of crises, but a Cuban Missile Crisis, where we came to the brink of nuclear extinction, is a lot worse than a Cuban sonic crisis, which we don't even know what it is.
What effect is Trump having on all this?
Well, Trump has had a net negative effect on American foreign policy. Basically, since 1945, since the end of World War II, the U.S. structure of alliances and institutions that we supported has created a framework for a relatively stable world and a relatively prosperous global economy. And Trump, who was the first major presidential candidate in 70 years to call that into question. Now, interestingly, after he was elected, he seems to have backed off on calling the security alliances into question.
Right, he said NATO was obsolete and then took it back.
That's right. Yeah. And the U.S.-Japan relationship, which is crucial to stability in East Asia, he has supported. So the security part doesn't seem quite as tenuous as it seemed during the 2016 campaign. On the other hand, I expect we're in for much worse coming up on trade, where he wants to renegotiate NAFTA, the U.S.-Korea agreement, and perhaps these will be destructive of the World Trade Organization and so forth. So you've seen the security framework basically shaken a bit, but not undone. The global climate regime, which was being developed, is being shaken by his withdrawal from Paris. And on trade, they haven't got there yet, but I expect that they're going to do some things that are going to shake up the international trading system.
Well, there's these two competing theories about how much power leaders have to actually affect change. And some people say, well, there's systems and there are institutions that restrain leaders. There are bureaucratic politics. There's all sorts of other norms and precedents that will hold them back. Or there's another school of thought that says, well, actually, leaders can make some major changes in American foreign policy. How do you judge those things? And when you think about Trump, how do you see that fitting into like a leadership theory?
Well, I wrote a book a couple of years ago called Presidential Leadership from the Creation of the American Era, which tried to look at the history of the 20th century and ask whether the United States would have risen to primacy no matter who was president. So I took whoever was the president and substituted in imagination the next most likely person who would have been president and asked whether they made a difference or not. And this is a way to test what sometimes is called agency, the individual, versus structure, mm-hmm. the larger framework. And I've used the metaphor of a river. Essentially, a river may be flowing rapidly, and you can say, well, that's because the mountains are channeling the river or because there's a lot of rainforests that are bringing water into this area and so forth. But then the question is whether somebody floating down that river is like an ant on a log being buffeted around from the rapids, or is like a whitewater rafter trying to steer the way between the rocks. And people who are fatalists, who take the emphasis on structure, saying we're all just ants clinging to the log, I think actually we're more like whitewater rafters or canoeists trying to steer our way through, and some get capsized and some don't.
Sometimes it feels like Trump is actually poisoning the water.
Either that or increasing the flow. I wrote a piece for Project Syndicate saying how much does Trump matter? And if we look back, imagine that it's 10 or 15 years from now, we look back and ask, will Trump have been a turning point in American history, or will he just be regarded as a blip, one of a curious set of characters that's been thrown up over the years? And I said I thought he'd probably be a blip unless he's reelected, which is possible, and unless he does something like get us into a major war, which would make him
also feels very
consequential.
Possible.
Yeah, would make him very consequential. So those are big ifs. But if those don't happen, then I think he will be regarded as a unique set of personal characteristics, which get a lot of attention, but which may not be as consequential as it seems at the time.
Let's cross our fingers. What about this idea of American decline? This is something you've also written a lot about, and you know there are many camps, and every 10 years this debate seems to come up that America's in decline, that our influence is waning. And you said you wrote a book in 2015 called Is the American Century Over? And you said, no, it's not. Is there something that, because there are all these people, the declinists, the people that say America is in decline, is there something that they and maybe the American public, is there some single most thing that they misunderstand about the nature of American power?
Well, I think there's a tendency among declinists to take the current problems of the moment and to magnify them or to project them into the future. And I think if you take a longer time horizon, you'll see that America has problems, but we always have. The question is, are they a lot worse than they were before? For example, Paul Kennedy wrote a great book, The Rise and Fall of Empires, and then decided that the Americans were in decline back in the 1980s, argued that we were spending more and more of our budget on defense. Well, in fact, we're not. In the Cold War, we spent about 10% of our GDP on defense. Today, we spend about 4%. So his theory was what he called imperial overstretch. We got more and more involved in more parts of the world. It was costing us more and more. That was burdening the economy. It's just, you know, the numbers don't support that. That's just an extrapolation for how things looked in the Reagan period when the defense budgets were going up. But it's not a good, if you go back to the Eisenhower period, but defense budgets were much higher.
Well, today is a really special day. And it's not just a special day because you're on the show, but also your favorite snack is a classic American symbol of fall. It's the apple.
That's true.
Jay, if you could bring that out. Thank you. Yeah. There are 7,500 types of apples in the world, and we've got three here. These are some of my favorites. This is the Honeycrisp. That's Cortland. And this one over here is Granny Smith.
Well, should we try some?
So yeah, absolutely. And actually, there's a little trick I like to call apples with peanut butter. And so we've got some peanut butter as well. And since it is fall, some caramel sauce.
Yeah, sounds good.
So my mother actually scolded me after she saw my first video of a snack break. She said to never take the snack first before your guest.
Oh, well, then so I will. I'll relieve you of
no,
a burden.
I don't want to get in trouble, you know. Going for the Honeycrisp, I see.
Well, and I think I'll try some caramel on my Honeycrisp. I actually grow apples and have an orchard in our farm in New Hampshire. So I spent last weekend picking a couple of barrels of apples.
Really? What kind of apples do you grow? I mean, there's so many.
Well, Cortlands, Macintoshes, and a lot of heirloom apples. This is a whole farm.
Heirloom apples?
And so I don't even know what some of them are.
Yeah, I went apple picking for the first time ever, weirdly, a couple weeks ago. It was a really fun experience because you can have like 8 or 10 different apples in the span of 5 minutes. If that were a full-time gig, I think I might get a little overwhelmed.
I'm going to try your peanut butter idea.
Oh, please, yeah. Can I ask you a question about when you came up with the term soft power, were you just like, man, I have nailed it? Was there like a eureka moment? What did it feel like?
No, in fact, I was writing a book to say why I thought Paul Kennedy was wrong. The book was called Bound to Lead. And I totaled up sort of American military power and American economic power and said there's still something missing. And it's that ability to get what you want through attraction, which is really not caught by the usual numbers. And I said, how can I express that? So I developed this term, soft power, as a way to express it. And then I thought, that's that. But to my great surprise, the term took off.
But it wasn't. It was like 10 years later, though. It wasn't.
Yeah, when I published the book was 1990, and I published an article in Foreign Affairs. It was based on the book. But it gradually crept into the language of politicians and political leaders, and particularly overseas. I guess the biggest surprise was not when people in Europe used it, but the biggest surprise was when Hu Jintao told the 17th Party Congress of the Chinese Communist Party in 2007 that China needed to invest more in its soft power. And that has led to thousands and thousands of articles in China about soft power. And and also thousands of inquiries of whether I will come and lecture on soft power more than I can possibly cope with.
And so soft power is this idea where it's not influenced by coercion, it's influenced by persuasion.
Well, power is the ability to affect others to get what you want. And you do that with coercion, sticks. You can do it with payment, carrots. Or you can do it with attraction, getting others to want what you want. And sometimes people don't pay enough attention to that, but it can be very important. For example, if you look at the Cold War and the American success in the Cold War, a lot of it came from not just our hard power, but from our soft power, our attractiveness. For example, if you look at the Berlin Wall didn't collapse under a barrage of artillery. The Berlin Wall went down under hammers and bulldozers wielded by people whose minds had been changed by being attracted to what was happening in the West.
And how would you apply that idea to today? Are we seeing a decline in American soft power?
Well, I think Trump is definitely undercutting American soft power in the sense that his budget director, Mulvaney, has explicitly said that the budget is not a soft power budget. And they've cut programs in the State Department, like the Fulbright program of exchanging scholars back and forth. And so they have deliberately tried to walk away from instruments that make us attractive. On the other hand, what's worth noticing is that a lot of a society or a country's soft power is produced by its civil society. So it's everything from Hollywood to Harvard that makes the United States.
And apples.
But the secret to American soft power is not just the government. And that's one of the problems the Chinese have, is that they tend to use party control to restrict their civil society, and that undercuts aspects of their civil society which otherwise would do a lot for Chinese soft power.
Oh, interesting.
You have an Ai Weiwei, brilliant artist, yeah, and you put him under house arrest.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been it's been a lot of fun for you to take these home with you.
Well, I'm going to take another apple home. Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you so much again.
Thank you.
This episode of Snack Break was recorded by the Hauser Digital Media team, produced by Tara Cavanaugh, and introduced by Harris Passeltiner. Introduction music was composed by Evan Fennessy. To learn more about the show or watch episodes instead of listen to them, find us on YouTube or visit our website at snackbreakshow.com.